Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. I am your reader, Ralph Skippers. Looking at today's headlines, local NAACP, more action needed on fair housing, organization offers support to grieving mothers. And let's start with National Guard team test PTC workers for COVID-19. No swabs are collected from about 350 employees of Prairie Industries after an outbreak at a company facility, by Bennett Goldstein. Dateline, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Dozens of employees in their vehicles lined the perimeter of a Prairie du Chien packaging company facility Tuesday, awaiting their chance to be tested for COVID-19. The operation, conducted by a 28-member specimen collection team from the Wisconsin National Guard, collected nose swabs from all of the about 350 workers of Prairie Industries North and South facilities. The outcome will determine whether the company's North facility at 800 North State Street will reopen or whether its South Prairie du Chien location, 38023 South Industrial Boulevard, will likewise close. Tuesday's drive to the testing site was one of the few opportunities packager Faith Jury has had to leave her Lynxville residence since her final night of work, April 23rd, at the North facility, where 9 employees have tested positive. "It was kind of scary," she said. "They had a meeting and told us someone had tested positive." The following day, operations at the North facility were reduced when the second shift, on which Jury serves, was suspended. The company announced the suspension of all operations at the facility last Friday. Employees are eligible for state unemployment benefits, but with the statewide economic disruption caused by emergency health orders, the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development is experiencing unprecedented call volumes. The department has received nearly 500,000 unemployment applications within a few weeks and is experiencing a backlog of claims. "The lines are busy," Dury said, "so we are without any income." To compound her problems, her roommate is no longer able to report to work because he has been in contact with Dury. "We are under quarantine until I find out if I test positive or negative," she said. "If you're a social person, it gets pretty depressing." Although Prairie Industries employees who have tested positive for COVID-19 to date worked at the North plant, there is no evidence to suggest the facility is where they contracted the disease, said Crawford County Public Health Officer Cindy Reniker. Jeff Panka, company president, said before the first reported cases, the company already had implemented social distancing rules and boosted disinfection procedures. "The situation is unprecedented, and he is unsure how it will impact the bottom line. We are learning the process as we go," he said, "doing the best things we can do to keep all of our employees safe while still keeping a business running. It's been fairly trying." Tuesday's testing occurred at the company's east location, 38037 South Industrial Boulevard, where operations have also been suspended. National Guard teams have conducted test sites across Wisconsin, resulting in the collection of almost 6,250 specimens. In southwest Wisconsin, a team was dispatched in April to Orchard Manor Long-Term Care Facility south of Lancaster and another to High Pro Inc. on Monday in Platteville. "We just keep them rolling," said Major Roger Lovelace, who oversaw Tuesday's operation. "We're doing one test every 2 or 3 minutes. The specimens will be sent to Madison Lab Exact Sciences, and the results could take 24 to 48 hours to be returned. Employees who test positive but lack symptoms will be quarantined for 2 weeks. Those with symptoms and a positive test result must be isolated for at least 7 days from the time symptoms first appeared and have 3 days without symptoms. They are not going to come back until I tell them they can come back," Reniker said. The public health department is also contact tracing for all positive cases. "In addition, we are tracking where all the employees work, where they take their breaks, if they smoke," Panka said, all the things that we can do to identify anything internal that might be missing. Those who test negative but who are unwilling to return to work may take unpaid leave without penalty, he said. Dury fears the prospect of returning to work, only to have plant operations suspended again if another employee tests positive. Another 14-day quarantine, potentially without income, would be a challenge. We're struggling, she said. Nobody has any way to help us contact unemployment. How do you expect to live? Next, organization offers support to grieving mothers. No Foot Too Small works to connect Iowa families who have experienced pregnancy loss or infant mortality, by Annie Mail. This article is accompanied by a picture of Lindsay Backus holding a stuffed bear as her husband Matt holds their infant daughter Cora. The bear is in honor of their son Cohen. After losing her baby during delivery, Lindsay Backus struggled with grief and isolated herself from others. She was unsure who would really understand the feeling of heartbreak she was experiencing. But not long after her son Cohen's death, Backus connected with a team of women who all shared tales similar to her own. She began to make the 90-minute trek from Dubuque to Iowa City in order to listen to the stories and found herself opening up to them. Meeting with the other women gave Backus the strength she needed while grieving and also gave her the opportunity to honor her lost child, she said. I enjoyed time with other mothers, Backus said. It was a huge part of my healing process. It's more like a friendship setting. Since the initial meetings with No Foot Too Small, Backus has become an ambassador for the organization and has helped form a group that meets in Dubuque. The Iowa City-based organization was founded by Robin Beaudreau and her husband Ryan, who lost their son, Beau. No Foot Too Small works to connect families throughout the state who have experienced pregnancy loss or infant mortality. Over the years, the organization has continued to grow, and through fundraising, it has begun opening birthing and bereavement suites at Iowa hospitals for moms who are expecting an infant loss after delivery. Boudreaux said Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center was the first to open a suite in 2019. Other suites are located at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City and Genesis Medical Center in Davenport. After losing her baby, Backus said she sat in her hospital room and could hear other babies around her crying. The noise was impossible for her to drown out. But the new suites offer a private space for mothers and their families to be together after the loss. It gives mothers and family members a separate space to grieve, Backus said. The one in Dubuque has a kitchenette. It's a bigger room so family members can come in and spend time with the baby. Amy Wright, director of maternal child services at Mercy One, said since its opening, the birthing and bereavement suite has provided families with extra privacy and precious time they need to be with their babies. Although the suite is primarily intended for parents who have lost a newborn, it has also been made available to families experiencing the birth of a baby born following a miscarriage or those who have a child admitted to the pediatric unit and need a quiet place to rest, Wright said. Since the coronavirus outbreak began, they have started holding their regular moms group meetings virtually. Right now, we are feeling like there is so much emphasis on frontline workers, and I think people are forgetting that people are still losing babies, Boudreaux said. We have taken our support groups and moved those virtually. Backus said the virtual meetings have been a great way to get to know mothers in other parts of Iowa. She said it has helped women who live in rural parts of the state connect with others and learn about the support available through No Foot Too Small. We have been able to have more reach, she said. That has been a really cool thing that has come out of the virus. Not only have the moms group meetings been moved to a remote, virtual setting, but its annual Angels in the Outfield fundraising event, which usually takes place at a minor league baseball game, has been moved online. Boudreaux said in past years, hundreds of families have gathered at a minor league baseball game, This year, families are encouraged to play baseball or catch at home and tune in to the virtual event May 17. As with all things No Foot Too Small, we look forward to celebrating angels and uniting families at this year's virtual Angels in the Outfield event, Boudreaux said. The silver lining to pivoting to a virtual event is welcoming angel families from across the state and across the country. During these unprecedented times, coming together, albeit virtually, is particularly special. The next virtual moms group will be 7 p.m. May 12th. For more information on how to tune in, go to www.nofoottoosmall.org. That's nofoottoosmall.org. And the final article from the front page, local NAACP, more action needed on fair housing. Group members say pandemic has made inequities more pronounced, urge Dubuque leaders to change new budget, by Thomas J. Barton. Members of the Dubuque branch of the NAACP worry financial constraints caused by the COVID-19 pandemic will further delay efforts to combat housing discrimination at a time when they say it is needed most. They say housing inequities in Dubuque have become more pronounced as a result of the current health crisis, which has led to a call by members for changes to the city's newly adopted budget. The impact of the pandemic will be affecting us all for the foreseeable future, wrote NAACP Friends of Fair Housing Committee members Lynn Sutton and Tom Loguidici in a recent note to council members. The modest changes we are requesting can help our city address the current situation as well as the long-term needs. The group has urged the city to fill a vacant assistant housing director position despite a city hiring freeze, to hire a consultant to develop a housing discrimination index and move forward with fair housing testing, and to set a deadline for an education, outreach, and rebranding effort to encourage greater participation in the city's housing voucher program by landlords. Council members approved creating the position at the end of last year at an annual expense of $110,500, but it remains unfilled to mitigate projected financial losses from the pandemic. City Manager Mike Van Milligan has said frozen positions will be re-evaluated each quarter. Loguidici and Sutton say promised tasks, namely a public overhaul of the city's housing voucher program, were not getting done prior to the pandemic. They argue that a hiring delay only will place an already overtaxed department further behind as it works to address affordable housing demands in the wake of the health crisis. Significant impediments to fair housing choice remain for people of color and low-income residents, who are hardest hit financially by the crisis, to access affordable housing options, according to a recent city analysis. Nearly 25% of all renters in the city spend at least half of their annual income on rent. Council members, though, twice have balked at prohibiting landlords from refusing to rent to tenants who rely on public assistance. Officials have said the city lacks accurate data on the prevalence of housing discrimination and how many landlords in Dubuque accept vouchers to implement such a ban. Council members passed a rule that takes effect this year requiring landlords to report whether they accept vouchers for each unit they own. And city housing inspectors just now are beginning to collect information from landlords and inform them about the housing assistance program, according to City Housing and Community Development Director Alexis Steger. Loguidici and Sutton, however, said Dubuque's five-year plan to address housing needs falls short in providing the data collection needed to develop effective policies. That includes providing funding for an independent survey of local housing practices recommended by a city-hired consultant to determine the likelihood that illegal housing discrimination is occurring. The city hired a Nebraska consulting firm in 2016 that conducted limited testing focused on how Dubuque landlords treated prospective tenants based on race and the use of housing vouchers. Test results found either no evidence of discrimination or were inconclusive. Logodici and Sutton argue that more robust testing is needed. "Right now, we feel we're running in circles," Sutton told the Telegraph Herald. "We keep hearing, we don't have the data. We don't have the data. Do the testing, get the data, and make a better comprehensive plan that has action steps." Steger said city officials hope to provide funding for fair housing testing in the fiscal year starting July 1, 2021, should revenues improve. "We have to be more strategic with that revenue, but it is something we still need to do and plan on doing," she said. City Council members Rick Jones, Brad Kavanaugh, David Resnick, and Danny Sprank echoed those comments. "I completely agree we need to move quickly as we can," Jones said. "The question is, how quickly can we?" And from the Dubuque and Tri-State page, 15 virus cases at local nursing home. COVID-19 outbreak at Dubuque Specialty Care results in testing of all its residents and staff. 15 cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed at a long-term care center in Dubuque, according to state data updated Tuesday. The outbreak at Dubuque Specialty Care, 2935 Kaufman Avenue, first was reported on April 28th, with one staff member and three residents testing positive for the coronavirus. But as of Monday, the state reporting system still listed just 4 cases at the facility. That total nearly quadrupled when figures were updated Tuesday, though it's unclear when those cases were confirmed, and the breakdown of how many of them are residents versus staff is unknown. On Monday, local public health officials disclosed that all residents and staff of the facility were tested late last week, but the results had not been received yet. Then, only 4 new cases of COVID-19 in Dubuque County were announced Tuesday, bringing its total to 156. The Dubuque County total soon could jump further, as the targeted testing of 1,000 people in the county will start today and run through Friday, May 8th. Those tested will all be residents and staff of long-term care facilities and individuals identified through contact tracing as having possible exposure to positive COVID-19 patients in Dubuque County. It is not open to the public. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Today's developments included: one new case was reported in Jones County, Iowa, pushing its total to 25. Statewide, 408 new cases were reported. That brings the statewide total to 10,111. Governor Kim Reynolds said 80% of the new cases were in the 22 counties that still have stricter business restrictions in place. She also said 261 of the 408 new cases were in just 2 counties, Polk and Woodbury. 6 more cases are reported in Grant County, Wisconsin, 3 in Lafayette County, Wisconsin, and 1 in Iowa County, Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, 8,566 cases have been reported. That includes 330 new ones reported Tuesday. 13 additional related deaths also were reported. The total now stands at 353. In Illinois, there were 2,122 new cases reported Tuesday, along with 176 deaths. The state totals now stand at 65,962 cases and 2,838 deaths. Next, Platteville offering grants to small businesses. Council okays emergency business support program that will offer grants of up to $1,500, by Bennett Goldstein. Dateline, Platteville, Wisconsin. Small business owners in Platteville struggling during the COVID-19 pandemic have a new resource to stay afloat. The city has created an emergency business support program that will offer grants of up to $1,500 for qualifying expenses. Platteville Common Council members on Tuesday night unanimously voted to allocate $20,000 from a city contingency fund to issue the grants. The program comes despite a likely revenue shortfall in the city budget stemming from the pandemic-related economic disruption. We're all questioning what is going to happen with the budget as it goes through the rest of 2020, but we do feel this is something that definitely is needed with the magnitude of the issue that we're in, said City Manager Adam Ruschel. To qualify, businesses must employ 10 or fewer people, have a physical location within city limits, and have been open to the public on or prior to March 17. The entity also must currently be closed or unable to conduct one of its primary modes of revenue generation. Businesses that have received other forms of government assistance at the local, state, or federal levels are ineligible, as are those that can operate remotely or in compliance with social distancing guidelines. Business owners can utilize the Platteville-issued grant to pay for mortgage or rent payments, utility bills, or software that would enable the move to online sales. Business owners can apply for funds through December 31st or until funding is depleted. Applications will be evaluated by Ruschel, Community Development Director Joe Carroll, and Administration Director Nicola Maurer. City staff members do not know how many Platteville businesses would qualify for funding. Ruschel said the program resembles those utilized in the cities of Moscone and Superior, but on a considerably smaller scale. Council member Robin Klein wondered whether the contingency fund might be needed for other expenses, but is hopeful the city could locate more funding from donors. The city also is looking to local economic partners for additional dollars. We have not planned a bake sale. We are not going to ask the police chief to increase fees for parking tickets, Council President Barb Dowse added. Beyond that, we'll have to get creative. And next, NICC, Peosta Plan to Boost Student Housing, by Ali Hinga. Dateline, Peosta, Iowa. Northeast Iowa Community College and the City of Peosta are firming up the details of a project to create housing for up to 200 students. The college's Board of Trustees and Peosta City Council members on Tuesday approved a development agreement for NICC to give the city about 2.7 acres on the west end of the college's Peosta campus for $1 for the development of student residential housing. City officials have found a developer who is already working on plans for the site. The council on Tuesday set a public hearing for Tuesday, May 12th, to turn the property over to College Suites LLC. It's exciting, said NICC President Liang Chi-Wei, who also said school officials look forward to engaging more students who previously might not have looked at NICC as a place to learn. The land would be used for a privately owned four-story apartment building to serve up to 200 students. The facility would offer 1 to 4 bedroom apartment style units furnished with appliances, the agreement states. The main floor would include a common area for students that could include spaces such as study areas, lounges, a social kitchen, and a fitness area. I think we're coming up with a great design and a great layout that I think will attract a lot of students just because of the proximity, the different things that the community has already, said Wes Schulte, the developer who will oversee the project. It will make a great scenario overall. He said the building's final design and total project cost still are being finalized. An NICC press release says construction would take 12 to 15 months, and the project represents an approximately $10 million private investment with a much larger potential economic impact. The development agreement stipulates that construction would need to be completed by October 1, 2022. I think it's a win for the city and for the college, but most importantly for our students, said Wendy Knight, NICC's Vice President of Institutional Effectiveness and Advancement. Per the agreement, the building design will need to be approved by an advisory council that includes officials from the college and city. the design and materials would be compatible and harmonious with the NICC campus. From the Dubuque and Tri-State News and Brief, Hy-Vee to limit meat purchases effective today in bid to avoid shortages. Hy-Vee will begin limiting meat purchases at all of its locations because of the prospect of shortages of items. The grocery store chain's policy begins today, according to a press release on Tuesday. It states that customers will be limited to 4 packages of any combination of fresh beef, ground beef, pork, and chicken. We have product available at our stores, but due to worker shortages at plants, as well as an increase in meat sales, customers may not find the specific items they are looking for, the release states. Ballots for curbside early voting available in Dubuque County. Ballots are available for in-person early voting in the June 2nd primary. In-person voting will be limited to curbside voting at Dubuque County Election Annex, 75 Locust Street in Dubuque, according to a press release. Voters should call 563-587-3870, extension 1980, upon arriving at the annex, and staff will help them cast their ballot while remaining in their vehicle. Voters are encouraged to cast their ballots by mail because of social distancing and other requirements prompted by the coronavirus pandemic. All registered voters have received forms to request an absentee ballot be mailed to them. Voters can complete the request form, sign it, and mail it back no later than 5 p.m. May 22nd in order to receive a ballot and a postage-paid envelope. Completed ballots must be postmarked no later than June 1. Redemption Center reopens to pent-up demand. Customers line up for 2 hours before Dubuque business ends its month-long closure, by Jeff Montgomery. 2 hours before Center Redemption had even opened its doors, the pent-up demand caused by its month-long closure was abundantly clear. Owner Shannon Moeller said customers began lining up outside the Dubuque business at 8 a.m. Tuesday. The Redemption Center opened at 10 a.m. and served more than 300 customers before closing 6 hours later. After seeing customers brave rainy conditions, Moeller is convinced that the Redemption Center will be busy in the days and weeks ahead. "I can only imagine what it will be like when it's sunny outside," Moeller said with a chuckle. "We are glad to be back open and happy to service our customers." Center Redemption announced its temporary closure in the first week of April. Moeller explained that the shutdown was a business decision, noting that coronavirus fears had compelled people to remain in their homes and sales had dropped significantly as a result. Redemption centers play a key role in statewide efforts to reduce and clean up litter by recovering beverage containers for recycling. Consumers in Iowa pay a 5-cent deposit when they purchase a beverage container and receive a 5-cent refund when they return it to a store or redemption center. Options for obtaining this refund have dwindled in recent months, however. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds in March temporarily removed a requirement that grocery stores and other retailers must take back the cans and bottles they sell. This change, coupled with the closure of redemption centers, left many local residents with a large collection of containers and nowhere to redeem them. Some of these bottles and cans made their way to Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque. Co-founder Jim Wagner said Veterans Freedom Center has been accepting bottle and can donations for a few years now. When the cans are picked up by a local redemption center, the Veterans Freedom Center keeps the proceeds and uses them to support operations. "In the past few weeks, we have probably seen 5 times the amount of bottles and cans that we normally receive," Wagner said. At Redemption Center, customers on Tuesday adhered to strict social distancing rules. Only 4 people were allowed in the facility at once, while the rest were asked to wait outside. Despite these unusual circumstances, the influx of customers was a positive sign for a business that has been battered by the effects of COVID-19. The Redemption Center also offers a commercial pickup service that involves partnering with entities including bars and casinos. With those businesses closed, that line of business has dried up too. The Redemption Center is open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, and 9 a.m. to noon on the second Saturday of each month. The business also allows customers to drop off their bottles and cans from 9 a.m. to noon, Mondays and Wednesdays, provided they make an appointment ahead of time by calling 563-585-1092. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Services for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Janet M. Winter Kenyon. Janet May Kennedy Winter Kenyon, age 74, of Dubuque, was called home peacefully at 7 a.m. on Sunday, May 3rd, at home, surrounded by her loving family. To celebrate Janet's life, there will be a celebration of her life held at a later date. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is in charge of arrangements. Janet was born on December 13, 1945, in Dubuque, daughter of Francis M. and Laverne Jasper Kennedy. Janet was a lifelong resident of Dubuque and graduated from Wallert High School, class of 1964. She married William R. Winter on September 9, 1967, in Dubuque, and they were blessed with two children. Janet later married William T. Kenyon on October 2, 2017, in Dubuque. He preceded her in death on December 23, 2018. Janet was employed in the bindery as a collator operator at William C. Brown Publishing in Dubuque for 39 years until her retirement in 2011. When she was able, she enjoyed spending time socializing with her family and friends or watching a Green Bay Packers game. Janet enjoyed spending weekends on the river with her family at their cabin in East Dubuque or working in her garden. She was a member of the Leakey Lodge at the Grand Tap. Janet was a gentle and selfless person who was always there with a kind word or a pat on the back. She was an amazing and strong mother, grandmother, wife, sister, friend, and caregiver who could light up a room with her smile, a look, or her witty sense of humor. Janet's family would like to extend a special thank you to the nurses and staff of Hospice of Dubuque for all of their kindness and professional care of Janice these past weeks. Memorials will be accepted by the family to be distributed among Janet's favorite charities. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Donald D. Atherton, Dateline Savannah, Illinois. Donald Dwight Atherton had trucking in his blood from an early age. At the age of 72, Don passed away Friday, May 1st, at home with family by his side. A private family funeral service will be held. You may watch from your home on Facebook Live, 2 p.m. Friday, May 8, or any time after by going to the Funeral Home Facebook page and joining Don's group ahead of time. A memorial fund has been established. Friends and family are also invited to share in Don's life at lawjonesfuneralhome.com. Gary A. Barr, Dateline, Waukon, Iowa. Gary Allen Barr, 74, of Waukon, died May 4th. Graveside services will be held Thursday, May 7, at 10 a.m. at Oakland Cemetery in Waukon, Iowa. Leo J. Tillman. Leo J. Tillman, age 57, of Dubuque, was called home peacefully at 1:45 a.m. on Monday, May 4, at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. To celebrate Leo's life, private family services will be held because of the current gathering restrictions due to COVID-19. A celebration of Leo's life and massive Christian burial will be held at St. Patrick's Church at a later time. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is in charge of arrangements. Leo was born on April 11, 1963, in Dubuque, son of John and Elizabeth Betty McPollen Tillman. Leo was a lifelong resident of Dubuque, where he graduated from Audubon School and was a member of St. Patrick's Church. He was very interested in watching sports. His favorite teams were the Chicago Cubs, the Green Bay Packers, the Iowa Hawkeyes, the Dubuque Thunderbirds, the Dubuque Fighting Saints, and the Dubuque Devils, where he would proudly watch his great-nephew Isaac play. Leo was also an avid NASCAR fan, and his favorite driver was Jeff Gordon. Leo enjoyed the simple things in life, such as a nice long walk alongside and getting together with family and friends for outings, especially if Happy Joe's Pizza was involved. We are deeply saddened to no longer have Leo here with us on this earth, but take some comfort in knowing that he is now resting peacefully and is reunited with his loved ones called home ahead of him. Leo's family would like to thank Dr. Christopher Still and all of the nurses and staff of Mercy One Dubuque for their outstanding care of Leo. Also, a heartfelt thanks to all the staff at ARC, who were really like extended family to Leo, for all of their love and care throughout the years. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Carlos Arbelez. Carlos Arbelez, 42, of Dubuque, died May 3rd. Carlos was born August 14, 1976, in Colombia, South America, the son of Gustavo Arbelez and Gloria Correa. On July 23, 1999, he married Anna in New York. Together, they welcomed a daughter, Camilla, and shared many wonderful years. Robert Weber, Dateline Dunlap, Iowa. Robert Weber, 90, of Dunlap, passed away on April 24th at home from natural causes. Military graveside services are pending and will be held in Pleasant Hill Cemetery, Dunlap, by the Dunlap American Legion Post, number 244. Donald Wagner, Dateline Farmersburg, Iowa. Donald Herbert Carl Wagner, 88, of Farmersburg, died Tuesday, May 5th, at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Due to state and federal guidance on gatherings due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the family will not be having a public memorial at this time. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Monona, Iowa, is assisting the family. John W. White, Dateline Hanover, Illinois. John Jack Whitney White would light up a room with his storytelling and laughter. At the age of 84, Jack passed away peacefully in his home on Sunday, May 3rd. A private family funeral service will be held. A memorial fund has been established. Friends and family are also invited to share in Jack's life at lawjonesfuneralhome.com. William E. Green, Sr., Dateline, Masbach, Illinois. William Eldon Green, Sr., age 71, of Masbach, passed away Saturday, May 2nd, in his home. A private family funeral service will be held in his honor, with burial taking place at Albrecht Cemetery. Family and friends are invited to share in Bill's life at lawjonesfuneralhome.com. Elaine K. Siverson, Dateline, Elkader, Iowa. Elaine K. Sarge Siverson, 97, of Elkader, died Monday, May 4th, at Mercy One Medical Center in Elkader, Iowa. Services are pending with Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Elkader, Iowa. Nicena M. Barth. Nicena M. Sina Barth, 62, of Dubuque, died May 4th. To celebrate Sina's life, private family services will be held. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is in charge of arrangements. A few articles from the news in brief. Joe Davies County to receive more than $48,000 in additional public housing funds. Joe Davies County, Illinois, will receive more than $48,000 in additional public housing funds as a result of the passage of the federal coronavirus relief bill. The money is part of $4.2 million in funding coming from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Supplemental Public Housing Operating Funds and Voucher Programs, according to a press release from U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos, a Democrat from Illinois. The money will provide public housing authorities with financial resources for management, maintenance, and resident services and support public housing efforts to prevent, prepare, and respond to the coronavirus pandemic, according to the release. The Housing Authority of Joe Davies County will receive $45,672 in supplemental funds and $2,578 in voucher funding, according to the release. Manchester Chamber to launch virtual business coaching development initiative, Dateline Manchester, Iowa. Manchester Area Chamber of Commerce has launched a program offering free coaching for startup businesses, business management coaching, and roundtable business discussion opportunities. Virtual Entrepreneur Lab is offered in partnership with the Rural Ideas Network, according to a press release. The network is a nonprofit organization that assists growth in rural communities. The release states that the initiative also will provide professional development panels and a business accelerator program. Contact Jessica Pape at macc@manchesteriowa.org or 563-927-4141 for more information. Bellevue officials announce cancellation of Heritage Day's celebration, Dateline Bellevue, Iowa. The city of Bellevue has canceled the 2020 Heritage Day's celebration due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The decision was made Monday night by Bellevue's mayor and city council, according to an announcement on the Bellevue Heritage Day's Facebook page. The event is held annually to celebrate July 4th. This year, the 58th annual event was slated for July 3rd and 4th. The post states that the event is scheduled to return in 2021. Beckman Catholic sets revised date for commencement, Dateline Dyersville, Iowa. Beckman Catholic High School has announced a revised schedule for activities due to the coronavirus pandemic. Senior awards, baccalaureate, and commencement events for the class of 2020 will be held July 12th. We are looking to have all of our events on one day due to the coronavirus situation, stated Principal Marcel Kielkucki in a press release. It's our hope we can have these special events in their traditional format, but will adjust as needed based on what will be allowable for large group gatherings at that time. School officials also canceled the spring musical, Beauty and the Beast. Those who have purchased tickets can request a refund or donate the cost of their tickets to the school's drama department. Western Dubuque sets potential dates for prom graduation, Dateline Epworth, Iowa. Western Dubuque Community School District officials have set two potential dates for high school prom and graduation. Prom will be held on June 20th and graduation on June 28th if COVID-19 pandemic restrictions have been lifted, Superintendent Rick Colpitz stated in a letter to parents. It states that if restrictions remain in place, prom will be held July 18th and graduation July 26th. A time has not been set for prom, but the letter states that the graduation times are 12:30 p.m. at Cascade High School and 2 p.m. at Western Dubuque. If restrictions remain in place through July, a virtual graduation ceremony will be held and prom will be canceled. National Foundation awards more than $70,000 to local COVID-19 relief. A national foundation has donated more than $70,000 to COVID-19 relief efforts in the Dubuque area. The Denver-based Morridge Family Foundation recently awarded $72,500 to Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque, according to a press release from the Colorado organization. It states that the money is part of $1 million in emergency relief funding being distributed to 14 community foundations and United Way organizations that will allocate funds to local nonprofit organizations providing assistance related to the coronavirus pandemic. The local community foundation, in turn, announced Tuesday that it is awarding the funding in amounts of $5,000 to $10,000 each to Almost Home, Convivium Urban Farmstead, Dubuque Dream Center, Do Ride, Every Child, Every Promise, Foundation of Youth, Project Rooted, and Presentation Lantern Center. Popular Manchester Rhubarb event not to be held this year. Dateline Manchester, Iowa. A popular Manchester event will not be held this year, but the cancellation is not tied to the COVID-19 pandemic. Manchester Area Chamber of Commerce reports that street projects have prompted it to call off this year's iteration of Rhubarb on the River. The event has been held for the past 3 years. Last year's event featured street vendors, runs, a variety of rhubarb food items, children's activities, and live music. Bank donates $25,000 to Galena ARC, Dateline Galena, Illinois. Illinois Bank and Trust will donate $25,000 to Galena Art and Recreation Center to assist the nonprofit organization during the COVID-19 pandemic. The bank is contributing $100,000 to nonprofit organizations in areas where it has locations, according to a press release. Galena ARC provides children with recreational opportunities outside of a school setting and has remained open during the pandemic. Funds from the bank will help support child care programs. Headlining the sports page, USHL Draft, Saints Reload in Draft. Dubuque takes 18 players in Phase 2 of USHL Draft by Jim Leitner. When Kyle Larson finally exhaled late Tuesday afternoon, he felt pretty good about the Dubuque Fighting Saints roster moving forward. The Saints general manager took 18 players over 16 rounds during Phase 2 of the United States Hockey League draft. Dubuque's protected list also includes 10 players taken Monday in Phase 1 for 2004-born players only and 17 players previously on the active roster or affiliates list. "Today went amazing," Larson said minutes after the draft concluded. "It seems like every year I'm a little anxious going into it. But because the draft is so big and there are so many players out there, a lot of times you can get the players you really want, especially after the first round or two. There were guys still available that we thought would be gone, so we're excited." Here is a capsule look at the Dubuque Fighting Saints picks on Tuesday. Tristan Lemire. The Saints took the 5'9", 165-pound center from Mirabel, Quebec, in the first round, 14th overall. The 2001 birth year player and Denver University commit tallied 30 goals, 62 points, and 14 penalty minutes in 44 games for the Flin Flon Bombers of the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey League. He finished 7th in league scoring. "He's a speedy skater, a shooter, a scorer, and he's great on the power play," Larson said. "There's still work to be done to get him here. That's where we're going to have to do some recruiting." Ryan Alexander. The 5'10", 162-pound center from Toronto went in the second round, 30th overall, after recording 18 goals, 58 points, and 22 penalty minutes in 45 games for the St. Michael's Buzzers of the Ontario Junior Hockey League. The 2002-born Alexander is committed to Arizona State, and NHL Central Scouting lists him as the number 161st ranked draft-eligible skater in North America. Dubuque has a long history with Arizona State, and the coaches at Arizona State were really happy about me being drafted there, Alexander said. "They wouldn't want me any other place, so I know it's going to be a great place to develop. They know how to win, too, so it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it." PJ Fletcher. Dubuque picked the 6'2", 186-pound center from Frisco, Texas, in the third round, 45th overall. This season, the 2001-born forward tallied 6 assists in 30 games for Quinnipiac University in the ECAC. He previously played for Wenatchee of the British Columbia Junior Hockey League. he continues a recent tradition of players returning from college to play in Dubuque. I really liked how J.D. Greenway went from Wisconsin to Dubuque to Maine, Fletcher said. I played against him this year, and I was impressed. What they do there in Dubuque is awesome, and I know they're going to help me develop this year. Drake Bergen. The 51st pick, acquired from Muskegon, the Saints selected the 6-foot, 181-pound right defenseman early in the fourth round. The 2000-born native of Winnipeg, Manitoba, registered 12 goals, 53 points, and 27 penalty minutes in 60 games for the Winkler Flyers of the Manitoba Junior Hockey League. Finn Brown. With their own fourth-round pick, 60th overall, the Saints selected the 6'2", 182-pound left wing from North York, Ontario. The 2002-born Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute commit had 29 goals, 54 points, and 20 penalty minutes in 53 games for St. Michael's of the OJHL. Spencer Kring. The Saints selected the 6'2", 180-pound right defenseman in the fifth round, 76th overall. The 2001-born native of Hobart, Wisconsin, recorded 7 goals, 16 points, and 28 penalty minutes in 50 games for Wilkes-Barre Scranton in the North American League. Nacogdoches Grays. With the 84th pick acquired from Sioux Falls, the Saints took the 6-foot, 180-pound center from Winnipeg. The 2001-born dual citizen scored 24 goals among his 74 points in 52 games for Dolphin Kings and finished third on the Manitoba Junior Hockey League scoring chart. Jacob Borzecki. With their own 6th-round pick, 91st overall, the Saints drafted the 6'1", 198-pound right wing from Köln, Germany. The 2002-born forward had 10 goals and 24 points in 35 games for Red Bull this season. He was born in Syracuse, New York, holds Polish, German, and U.S. citizenship, and was ranked number 64 among European skaters for the NHL draft this summer. Samu Salminen. The 6'2", 176-pound center from Helsinki, Finland, went in the 7th round, 106th overall. A 2003-born forward, he tallied 15 goals and 43 points in 30 games for the Jokerit Junior program. He also represented Finland at the World Under-17 tournament. His older brother, Sammy, played at Northern Michigan. Marcus Cavella Carlson. Dubuque took the 5'9", 176-pound center wing from Västra, Sweden, in the 8th round, 121st overall. The 2001-born forward recorded 7 goals and 13 points in 29 games for his hometown junior team this season. Jake Goldowski. The 6'3", 205-pound center from Thornhurst, Pennsylvania, went in the 9th round, 136th overall, and is a 2000-born player. The former National Team Development Program member had 14 goals and 33 points in 62 games for the Saginaw Spirit of the Ontario Hockey League this season. Ian Devlin. The Saints selected the 6-foot, 184-pound defenseman from Toronto in the 10th round, 151st overall. A 2002-born prospect with U.S. and Canadian citizenship, he had 9 goals and 22 points in 53 games for the St. Michael's Buzzers of the OJHL. He was born in Memphis, Tennessee. Austin Overetz. Dubuque took the 5'8", 168-pound right defenseman from Canonsburg, Pennsylvania in the 11th round, 166th overall. A 2003-born prospect, he logged 10 goals and 45 points in 51 games for the Pittsburgh Penguins Elite Under-16 team this season. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening, and be safe. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.